Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll hear from Larry Mustaine, who grinds heirloom corn at his family's mill in West Virginia.
All different colors, actually. Purple.
It's beautiful.
And red, and some of it's orange.
And in Kentucky, we'll travel along the bourbon whiskey trail.
And you can smell a little sweetness here.
Now, when you smell this, don't stick your head in here and take a big whiff. Adam and I don't want to carry you out.
We'll also hear from a coal miner in southern West Virginia who is worried as more and more mines are laying off workers.
Worked for a surface mine. Been doing it for 7 years. I mean, you're with your colleagues at work more than you are home. Honestly, you do anything for them and they do anything for you too. So, I mean, it's just a good field to be in. It really is.
These stories and more in the next hour. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. 26-year-old Jordan Bridges is a coal miner in Logan County in the heart of West Virginia's southern coal fields in the mountainous green landscape of Appalachia. Jordan and his 21-year-old wife, Erica Bridges, are both worried about what it would mean for them and their 2-year-old daughter if Jordan loses his job. They don't want to move away from family and friends and the place they grew up, but they don't see any other good jobs or industries in this area apart from coal. Reporter Rachel Rohr of NPR and WBUR's Here and Now recently talked with Jordan about his job and why he wants to continue working as a coal miner.
Rachel Rohr, and this is Alternate Routes from WBUR and NPR's Here and Now. We're continuing our drive cross-country, talking to young people ahead of the midterm elections. Today we're in West Virginia, the second largest coal producer in the U.S. after Wyoming. 95% of the electricity generated in West Virginia last year came from coal-fired electric power plants. While driving, we saw billowing smokestacks and cooling towers, license plates that boasted friends of coal, and a roadside political banner urging voters to elect a miner for miners. I'm meeting up with a young coal miner in Logan County, in the heart of West Virginia's southern coal mines and the mountainous green landscape of Appalachia. We're in a quiet meeting room of a hotel in the strip mall complex along Route 119, which also includes a Walmart supercenter, a Lowe's home improvement, and a movie theater. Jordan Bridges is 26 years old, and he's here with his 21-year-old wife, Erica, and their 2-year-old daughter, Gracie.
I live and work in Logan County, West Virginia. Worked for a surface mine. Been doing it for 7 years. It's probably one of my most favorite things to do outside of my family, so I really enjoy doing it. My dad done it. My grandfather's done it. Dad worked underground and surface at the same time. So he'd come home and go right back to work the same day. So I guess I got that from him as far as work ethic and, just wanting to provide a living, you know.
Tell me about the decision to follow in your dad's footsteps. Was there a big decision there, or was it an easy decision?
Years ago, you could take your kids to work with you, it was frowned upon, but they done it anyway. He took me to work one time, and I actually got to sit in a drill with him that drills holes in the ground. And ever since then, I've always just wanted to do it. So that's where I really got my first start on it. They let me be around everything, see the equipment, and I just knew I wanted to do it from there.
Tell me about growing up in this area. I imagine that you grew up right around here?
Yes.
In Logan?
Yes.
What was it like growing up around here, and what made you want to stay?
I guess all of her family's here. I mean, most of her family's still here. My whole family's still here. I mean, we was raised here. I'd like to raise my daughter here. I got friends, family. A small town. Kind of get to know a lot of people, and you just like to stay around.
Did you ever go away for school or anything like that?
No. I went to college for a few years. Decided it just wasn't for me. I'd rather work with my hands.
Was that around here that you went to college?
Yes. I went to Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College. Went by a year, and I just I just left. I said I just wanted to work. That's all I want to do is just work. So that's what
I did. You been studying?
Well, I was going into radiology. Then I backed out. I don't want to sit behind a desk at all. I don't want to be indoors. I get to be outside what I do in the weather, and I enjoy that.
What are some of the stories that you grew up with about mining?
It was dangerous, but they made friends. It was like, you're with your colleagues at work more than you are home. So, you kind of get to know them. You get to know their families. They know my family. My dad knows their families. You know what I mean? It's like a big family. And honestly, you do anything for them, and they do anything for you, too. So, it's just a good field to be in. It really is.
That was Jordan Bridges talking with Rachel Rohr. A few weeks ago, Jordan just sent Rachel this update. I still have a job and get to work, but there were 2 mine sites shut down and over 200 people laid off work, and they gave me and the other mines around here another 60-day notice and a pay cut. You can hear the rest of Rachel's interview with Jordan on our website at wvpublic.org. We'll continue to stay in touch with Jordan to find out how things go for him and his family. This is Inside Appalachia. Earlier this month, students, local officials and candidates for office, community organizers, and residents from across our region packed into the Apple Shop Theater in downtown Whitesburg, Kentucky, to participate in a public forum. The subject of the evening was possibilities for economic transition in the coalfields, but looking far beyond our own mountains for inspiration and ideas. WMMT's Sylvia Ryerson has this report.
In the 1970s, Appalachian scholars Helen Lewis and John Gaventa began studying the mining regions of South Wales in the UK. Much like in Appalachia, in the first half of the 20th century, coal mining was the dominant industry for these rural communities. And as in the US, this mining spurred the rapid industrialization of Britain and the greater UK. But the mines in South Wales shut down almost entirely 30 years ago, and mining communities were forced to reinvent their economy. Now, as Central Appalachian coal employment continues to decline, many see it as an opportune time to again look across the ocean for ideas and solidarity. Tom Hansel, an Apple Shop filmmaker and professor at Appalachian State University, has continued this international exchange and is finishing a documentary titled After Coal, Welsh and Appalachian Mining Communities. The film explores the parallels between the two regions and highlights locally based solutions that have been developed in Wales. And on the evening of October 7th, Hansel was joined by 2 of his Welsh collaborators, Howell Francis, a labor historian and Member of Parliament for the Aberavon region of Wales, and his wife, Mare Francis, founder of the Dove Workshop, a woman-run education center which is considered an international model for community development. To get the conversation started, Hansel shared a few clips from his film project. Here are the voices of Howell and Mare Francis, as featured in the film.
Communities always change. Industries come and go. And it was foolish of us to think at the end of the 85 strike that it was the end of the world. It was an opportunity for a new beginning.
The Dove Workshop was set up during the miners' strike of 84-85 by a group of women who supported their husbands and thought that they needed to have a place to train so that they could earn some money.
What you struggled with in Appalachia and we struggle here in South Wales, how do we actually control our own destiny? How can we achieve sustainable economic development for the benefit of local communities?
Mare and Howell Francis then took the mic themselves and walked the audience through a series of slides outlining some of the main elements and examples of success in the Welsh transition, including the creation of locally run mining museums, the development of an extensive mountain bike trail, a new wind farm, and access to lifelong learning opportunities. Hal and Mayor Francis were then joined by Evan Smith, a staff attorney at the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, and Robin Gabbard, Associate Executive Director for the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, based in Perry County. After brief comments, the mic was passed out to the audience for an open Q&A discussion. Letcher County artist Carrie Wells asked the guests from Wales what kind of role small businesses played in their transition.
You cannot have a successful, prosperous business community unless you have skills. There is no doubt about that. So you've got to start with that. You can't start with the culture of miners who said once the industry went, well, we demand that their factories should be arriving here on our doorstep to replace those mines. Well, that's not going to be the case, is it? You know, we live in a global economy, and multinational companies will not do that. So we need to ask the question, well, how do you revive or create a new economy that is, in fact, different? And if you were to ask the present generation in former mining communities, would you want to have the pits reopen? Universally, they would say no. And one generation after another would say, I don't want my son, or in the case, a daughter, go down the mines.
I want to pivot off one thing that Hal says quickly.
Evan Smith of the Appalachian Citizens Law Center.
I think that one of the biggest changes that we have been experiencing in this area and are going to experience even more is for the kids that are graduating high school now, it's no longer an option to get, you know, a good salary from a job in the mines straight out of high school. And I think that that's actually a reality that most of the global economy has faced for a long time. You know, that there's not a lot of places in the world where you can make $75,000 with a high school degree. Now, jobs in the mines are hard. I'm not saying that that is an easy life, but I am saying that it is a way that people have been able to provide for their families without having to invest in as much education as a lot of other people in the national and global economy have had to. And so looking forward, we're going to have to teach our kids that you are going to have to invest in more education, not only just attending school, but also figuring out how to really not just be in a chair, but be engaged while you're there. Because whether if you're going to start a small business, whatever the option is going to be is going to require creativity and skills.
Appalachian scholar and founding member of the Appalachian Welsh Exchange, Helen Lewis.
One of the things I think we've been misled on is that if we will just get rid of the regulations against health and air and that sort of stuff by the government, the coal industry will rise up again and we will have the coal industry. And I think we just have to recognize that if coal is going and we can have a new industry, we need to look around and see what we've got that we can use. And one would be, what are our resources, and where's the land? And although the coal industries may be closing, they still own a lot of that land. And I talked with the winery over in Wise recently about them raising all these great grapes and producing great wine and so forth. And he says, we can't get any more land because they will only lease it for a year, and you can't plant an orchard, and you can't plant grapes and that sort of stuff. So I think we've got to find a way to get our resources back. One would be the land, and the other would be, you know, we need funds. It's time that we really sought some reclamation, you know, or from the coal companies that have been here, if we can trace back who they were. I mean, what happened with tobacco was that they put a great deal of funds from the tobacco industry into this tobacco commission, which has been able to really give a lot of money for a lot of local stuff. I spent a lot of time working in Wise County in the coal fields. And when I first came there in 55, there were 100 orchards all over the hurricane, and great apple cider and great apples. There's one little orchard there now. So why can't we go back and get our land and then do some of thinking about new industry and find some ways of getting funding from as reparations for all the destruction that has been done.
As always, I agree with so many things that Helen just mentioned.
Again, Evan Smith.
And, you know, it needs to come from a variety of places, but just to sort of pick out one, you know, there is this federal abandoned mine land fund. And it's, you know, like our future, this fund is complex. But there's about $2.5 billion that's unappropriated that's in this fund that, you know, is meant to be used for the legacy costs that come from, you know, the environmental harms that mine did in this area before it was regulated. And I think it's not hard to drive down the road and to say, oh, look, there's some of those. And so if we could find a way to get some of those funds and put them to use and really be smart about the way we use them. I mean, I think that it's important that we extend our water lines. It's important that we, you know, turn our hills into something that you could grow apple trees on. But while we're doing it, we also want to make sure that we're using local contractors, that we're really figuring out the way that we can make each dollar of that circulate as many times as possible and generate future dollars.
And beyond that, truly encouraging those who have profited from the extractive resources over many, many years to reinvest back into those communities. And that's something we feel very strongly about, encouraging those strong mineral champions and that have made a tremendous amount of wealth from our resources to think about this community differently. And by community, I mean all of southeastern Kentucky and Appalachia.
That was Robin Gabbard of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky. Ray Tucker of Pulaski County gave the final comment from the audience.
Instead of still playing the blame game of who's going to pay, who benefited, I think we really have to appeal back to the national government, just like you all did in Wales, and say all the citizens benefited. Everybody that bought a Toyota got a cheaper Toyota because it was built with cheap energy. Everybody benefited. And so the whole nation has to be part of the reclamation that has to happen. And I think, kind of like the Appalachian land study that happened with who owns the land, I think we need to do an Appalachian land study of what is it going to cost to fix it, and then say, how are we going to do it? And then those will create jobs fixing it, and then it'll create something going forward with what we can do with our land after it's repaired.
I agree very strongly that this is a national problem. This is not a regional problem. This is not a local problem. That, you know, we are part of the United States of America. We fight for this country, and when we go to war, and I think that the national government has an obligation to help us get our economy back on its feet. When, you know, military bases move and close, the federal government helps people get jobs. There's a lot of examples of, like, you know, when the timber industry was changing in the Northwest, that the federal government got involved in helping those economies transition. So I think that we're so used in this area to thinking about Washington, D.C. being the problem, and that we are, you know, being besieged by bureaucrats in D.C. But I think that Washington, D.C., and where those representatives from the entire country, the fact that they are there, we have to think of D.C. as part of our solution.
Again, that was Evan Smith of the Appalachian Citizens Law Center. There will be another community conversation on this topic at the Arts and Youth Forum on Tuesday, October 28th at 7 p.m. at the Harlan campus of Southeastern Kentucky Community and Technical College. For WMMT Mountain Community Radio, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
As the coal industry continues to decline, some educators are exploring how to encourage their students to pursue STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, like in Paw Paw, West Virginia. Students at that very small school are wrapping up a very big science project with help from NASA, like in Paw Paw, West Virginia. Students at that very small school are wrapping up a very big science project with help from NASA. They're building a full-scale model of a satellite. It's something you might not expect to see at the second smallest school in the state. But, as Liz McCormick of West Virginia Public Radio reports, one teacher had the ambition and enthusiasm to make it happen.
Seven, six.
Space exploration. The universe, satellites, rockets, it's what many kids dream about.
And lift off, the final lift.
And for the middle and high school students at Paw Paw schools, dreams like those are not so far away.
Just remove that. Yeah, it should be fine there.
7th through 12th graders here are building a full-scale model of NASA's magnetospheric multi-scale satellite.
In short, the MMS mission is studying how Earth's magnetic field works.
Todd Ensign is with NASA's Educator Resource Center in Fairmont.
In particular, you know, how it helps to protect us from high energy particles. Life on Earth would not exist, the way we know it at least, if it weren't for Earth's magnetic field.
The NASA Center in Fairmont provides free training to instructors who want to teach STEM subjects. 2 years ago, Paw Paw's only 7th through 12th grade science teacher, Carol Corrier, went to one of the trainings. It was about the MMS mission and how its four satellites will monitor solar weather after they're launched in March. Corrier was so inspired by what she learned, she immediately brought it into her classroom. She first taught her kids about solar weather using iPads, and then they started making small paper models of the MMS satellite. About a year ago, she decided to take it even further when she and her students toured the MMS mission at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland.
I asked the contact person, what would it take to build a model of the satellite? What if our students did that? And so one thing led to another, and we came up with this idea that why not build a full-scale model?
She talked about her idea with her colleague, Chris Panaris, Paw Paw School's STEM instructor. NASA was so intrigued by their enthusiasm that the agency agreed to provide all the materials for the project. Again, NASA's Todd Ensign.
We didn't pick a random school in the state. We didn't pick Paw Paw because it was the second smallest school. We picked it because Carol and Chris have been very involved in NASA programs, and specifically, they've already done MMS with their students.
The year-long project has taken over Chris Panaris' construction and engineering shop. And Carol Corrier says sometimes space can get a little tight. But she says a small school like this is the ideal place for a project of this caliber.
We have the same cohort of students. So students that I have for science, Mr. Panaris will have for construction or mechatronics, or I may have in a chemistry course, or I've had them for biology. So we're all working with the same group of students.
Corrier says sometimes the demands on the students can be challenging, but she and other staff take care not to let the project interfere with other subjects.
We've been very cautious not to pull our kids out of courses that they need, you know, that they would be working on otherwise. We've done a lot of writing, we've done a lot of speaking and presentations, so we've been able to kind of support those other courses, but yet not actually ever pulling those students out of those classes.
Many of these kids say they might be interested in a career in a STEM field now, even if they'd never thought about it before. Carol Corrier hopes she'll be able to take her students to see the real MMS satellites when they're launched from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida in March. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Paw Paw.
Paw Paw. Growing up, this is the name I always called my grandfather. Did somebody's grandfather inspire them to name a town Paw Paw? We'll explore what's in the name of Paw Paw, West Virginia, after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Paw Paw, West Virginia, wasn't named after a grandfather. We chatted with Susan Moreland, who works in the local school there. She says the town gets its name from the fruit.
The Indians named this area Paw Paw after the fruit. And it's a fruit, kind of like a pear, a little bitter. Actually, out here on the school lawn, there's a couple pawpaw trees, and right now is the best time. They're in season. So help yourself to some.
If you have another story about pawpaw or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at @InAppalachia, and we just might explore it inside Appalachia. Speaking of pawpaws, the fruit, we wanted to find out if you can actually grow them in your backyard. We checked with Andy Moore, who's writing a book about pawpaws, and he gave us this advice.
If your goal is fruit, and I assume that's what you're after, you actually want to get pawpaws in full sun. They're commonly found along river bottoms in the wild, and if you can do your best to replicate that, that's the kind of soil they want, the deep alluvial soil.
You can also just go ahead and plant pawpaw seeds outside this fall. That way, they'll spend the winter outdoors and be ready for spring.
Typically, if you plant it in the spring, you'll see a pawpaw in about June or July. It takes about 6 to 8 years to get fruit from a tree that you've grown from seed.
So there you go. If you want to try to grow a pawpaw tree, but you don't want to wait 8 years to grow one from seed, there are nurseries that specialize in selling cultivated pawpaw trees. You can find a list of nurseries Andy recommends on our website at wbpublic.org. In southern West Virginia, Reed's Mill has been stone grinding local corn mill since 1791. Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Radio found one of the few grist mills that's been in continual operation in this country, and it grinds a local heirloom corn that's been passed down for generations.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is over.
The sound of tumbling corn kernels is mesmerizing. Larry Mustaine is the miller of Reed's Mill. He shows me an overflowing handful of what's called Bloody Butcher corn. It's called Bloody Butcher because when it's ground into cornmeal, it's white with flecks of bright red sprinkled throughout, like a butcher's apron. But before it's ground...
It's all different colors, actually. Purple.
It's beautiful.
And red, and some of it's orange. Some of it is white.
The dried corn is multicolored and magic. It's been passed down at Reed's Mill for generations. The corn might even go as far back to when Reed's Mill first opened in 1791. And there's something perfect about eating cornbread made from Larry's coarsely ground meal. It has a unique gritty texture. The butter clings to the bits of grit, and there's an earthier, more complex taste than commercially ground cornmeal. Spider webs cling to the wooden rafters above us as Larry pours the Bloody Butcher corn into an electric stone grinder. The mill's old water turbine behind us is rarely used these days. Along Second Creek, there were once 22 mills that ran by the rushing waters. Some were lumber mills and woolen mills, but most were grist mills like this one. Today, Reed's Mill is the only one standing. All the others have been closed for decades. The old buildings have all burned or are in disrepair.
Go to sleepy, go to sleepy, go to sleepy little baby. When you wake up, I make you up okay. Cornbread crumbling gravy. Go to sleepy, go to sleepy, go to sleepy.
A couple of years ago, Larry drove me to see one of these abandoned mills called Nichols Mill that was still standing. A swampy forest had grown up between the old wooden floorboards. I stumbled into knee-high water just outside the mill's main entrance. Now, that mill has been torn down, too. Larry says he used to drive his mother around these old back roads to see the abandoned mills just before she passed away. With a heavy heart, she used to sit and stare at the decaying old buildings, expressing a deep nostalgia for her childhood.
And it did, you know, it was like a scene out of the old South. And she'd say, it just looks like Gone with the Wind. And then the same thing down there at Nichols Mill, where we just was, she'd say, it's just like Gone with the Wind. It's all gone now, she'd say.
But it's not all gone. Not as long as Reed's Mill is still in operation. And there are still plenty of customers every Saturday when the mill is usually open. Larry sometimes opens the mill other days, too, if a group or a tour bus calls ahead. But Larry is now 77 years old, a retired school teacher. And though he doesn't plan on retiring from the mill anytime soon, he does admit that health issues have slowed him down in recent years. To complicate matters, Larry is losing a battle against the geese and deer. Last year, they ate his entire crop of Bloody Butcher corn. He claims the animals prefer the heirloom Bloody Butcher to the hybrid corn that grows in all the neighboring fields. Most of the customers who come to Reed's Mill seem to prefer the heirloom corn, too. They claim it has a different texture and taste compared with the yellow hybrid he also sells at the mill. One of these customers is Lowell Lewis of Frankford, who learned how to bake salt rising bread and cornbread from his mother.
She wouldn't use any store-bought cornmeal. It had to be stone ground from Reed's Mill.
To be able to continue selling heirloom corn at the mill this year, Larry found a nearly identical corn in Craigsville at Spring Creek Farm. Frances Meadows helps her father, Edgar Meadows, run the farm.
The Bloody Butcher corn is a very unique seed. It's been in our family for probably five generations. My dad's 93 years old, and he grows the Bloody Butcher every year.
This year, Frances sold Larry about 1,200 pounds of Bloody Butcher to grind at Reed's Mill. She also gets Larry to grind some of the Bloody Butcher into a coarsely ground polenta, which she sells to chef Tim Urbanek at Cafe Cimino in Sutton. It's early morning, around 6 a.m., and I'm standing with Chef Tim Urbanek in the kitchen of the Cafe Cimino Country Inn. Tim grew up in western Pennsylvania in a coal camp, and his mother, Julia Cimino, was a first-generation Italian immigrant from Calabria.
The polenta was a staple in our family. This is a polenta that I've known it all my life since I was a little kid. We add to this Romano cheese, fresh butter, and then we use water for the base.
This morning, Tim Urbanek cuts the thick polenta into triangular wedges. He dusts it in flour and a bit of salt and pepper, and then fries it in oil. Tim has been teaching his son Eli to cook their family recipes, which originated in Calabria. Tim's mother's maiden name is Cimino, and he named his restaurant after her. Julia Cimino is now 101 years old, and Tim brings her freshly made polenta when he visits.
And she's just, you know, has really brought culture into my life. So I still take her a little bite of food. I'm still the baby. She still calls me Timmy.
This morning, Tim is serving polenta for breakfast, along with an omelet, scones, date and molasses cake, and a fruit cocktail served with fresh mint and peach nectar. The polenta has crisp corners and a creamy texture inside. It's perfect.
This is a white Bloody Butcher corn. So when you look at our cornmeal, you'll see little specks of red in it.
This polenta is from locally grown heirloom Bloody Butcher cornmeal, grown by Frances Meadows and her 93-year-old father in Craigsville. Frances Meadows says they've had this heirloom seed in their family for about five generations. She says she grew up eating polenta, except here in West Virginia, everyone calls it corn mush.
Polenta is, you know, it's just a form of grits with, you can put different cheeses in there for flavoring. But in the old days, they made grits, but they called it mush.
Tim discovered this corn when he met Frances Meadows at a chef and farmer dialogue event in 2004. At the meeting, Meadows said that her family's farm had more than a ton of Bloody Butcher corn, but she couldn't find a buyer. Tim now buys about 350 pounds of it each year, and he's been using it for Cafe Cimino polenta ever since.
It's an antique corn, and it's really, really, the seeds are very, very hard to find.
Indeed, these seeds are rare, especially because few farmers even use their family's heirloom seeds anymore. Except for rare farmers, like Frances Meadows, this history would be lost.
It's family tradition. I think it's important if you've got an heirloom seed like that that's unchanged. I think it's everyone's responsibility to kind of protect that.
Someone who agrees with Frances is Dr. Jim Vedado, an anthropologist based out of Yancey County, North Carolina. He spent the last 15 years researching heirloom vegetables throughout Appalachia.
My research has shown that actually Central and Southern Appalachia is the most diverse food shed in most of North America, so all the U.S., Canada, and Northern Mexico.
Dr. Vedado also directs a seed bank called the Southern Seed Legacy Project, based out of Western Carolina University. This project helps encourage farmers throughout Appalachia, like Frances Meadows and Larry Mustaine, to save their family's heirloom seeds.
Most people I talked to talked about, well, this is part of our cultural heritage, you know, like it reminds me of my grandmother, who I used to farm with, who I used to grow this corn with, and every time I'm out in the field, I think of my grandmother.
And that's why Frances is growing her family's Bloody Butcher, not only to preserve her family's history, but to continue the food history that her family is connected to.
I mean, that's what America was started out on, and I think the younger generation needs to get involved and keep that tradition going.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table, eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd.
Ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love game all over.
Goodbye, don't you cry, I'm going to Louisiana. Buy a dog and a big fat hog and marry Susanna. Sing song, ding dong, gonna take a trip to China. Corn, bread, and butter beans, and there to Carolina.
Yeah. Corn, bread, and butter beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Hoeing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, the crazy fool, and love again all over.
Shoes and drinking booze is going against the Bible. A necktie will make you die and cause you lots of trouble. Streetcars and whiskey bars and kissing pretty women. Oh man, that's the end of a terrible beginning.
Corn, bread, and butter beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Hoeing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love again all over.
Can't read and don't care, and education's awful. Raising heck and writing checks, that ought to be unlawful. Sell coals and pretty clothes are just a waste of money. I can see how glad you'll be to marry me, my honey.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Hoeing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride a mule, a crazy fool, and love again all over.
From cornmeal to whiskey, we now travel to Kentucky to explore the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. Alan Little of WUKY of Lexington made a few stops at some of the distilleries along the trail recently and sent us this story.
For many a traveler, just getting to one of Kentucky's iconic bourbon distilleries can be half the fun.
The experience really starts when you turn off US 60 onto Grassy Springs.
That's Dee Ford, the home place manager for Woodford Reserve in Versailles.
You drive along and there's the horse track on the side, you see cows, it's windy road, and then you turn right and go up the hill and there's the distillery.
Woodford Reserve is just one of the many liquor producing operations along the ever-growing Kentucky Bourbon Trail, a tourism brainchild of the Kentucky Distillers Association. Bourbon Trail Director Adam Johnson says in less than 10 years, the popularity of one of Kentucky's signature industries has just taken off.
People want to learn more about the products that they're seeing on their shelves at their home state, and we're getting people from all across the country. I think it's something like 86% are from outside the state of Kentucky coming to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
The next tour is at 11:30.
And the distilleries have poured millions of dollars into creating state-of-the-art welcome centers, gift shops, and tasting rooms for the ultimate bourbon experience. Jonathan Haddix was my tasting guide at Wild Turkey Distillery.
This is going to be 6, 7, and 8-year-old bourbon, predominantly 8. It's going to have more of a spicy caramel tone to it with some vanilla in there as well. So if you haven't had Wild Turkey, you know that's a great place to start.
But no tour would be complete without a behind-the-scenes look at how all that bourbon gets made. Jim Rutledge, master distiller at Four Roses, was more than happy to show me around his operation.
And you can smell a little sweetness here.
Now, when you smell this, don't stick your head in here and take a big whiff. Adam and I don't want to carry you out.
The great thing about doing the Bourbon Trail is the variety of atmospheres and experiences. You can spend a whole day exploring larger operations like Woodford Reserve, Wild Turkey, or Four Roses. Or if you have just an hour or two, then you might want to pop into Altec's Town Branch Craft Distillery in downtown Lexington. Master Distiller Mark Kaufman.
We're a stop right in the metropolitan area. You can either start here or finish here. Last year, we've seen about, 30,000 people. This year, we expect to see about 60,000 people coming to Lexington. Out of those numbers, it's amazing the percentage are from outside of not only Lexington, but outside of the state and outside of the country.
And I can certainly vouch for that international appeal. I had a couple from Eastern Europe on my tour of Woodford Reserve.
But I love that it's a really small family type of the distillery, and I'm surprised about the size.
I really like that it's in the country, the horse farm around here, that's very nice.
What did you know about Kentucky before you came here for the first time?
Oh, well, I know they make whiskey. Well, bourbon. Sorry about that.
Whether you're a dabbler, a connoisseur, or somewhere in between, a trip along the Bourbon Trail is sure to hold your interest, and it's definitely something every Kentuckian should not miss. Reporting in Lexington, I'm Alan Lytle.
Every October, author and West Virginia native Homer Hickam makes a trip to West Virginia for the annual Rocket Boys Festival in Beckley. But he also makes a point to stop in on his hometown of Colwood in McDowell County during his visit. Liz McCormick with West Virginia Public Radio got the chance to sit down with Hickam and hear about his hometown, current work, and of course, Appalachia.
Homer Hickam grew up in the small town of Colwood, West Virginia, during the 1940s and 50s, when Colwood was a busy company town and Sputnik was first launched in space. It was his childhood experiences that inspired him to write his famously known memoir, Rocket Boys, later adapted into the film October Sky. Since then, Hickam has written an array of novels, including genres in science fiction, military, stories on Colwood, and much more. His newest work, just sent to his publisher, features a family legend about an alligator his mother raised in West Virginia in 1935, named Albert.
My dad said, "It's either me or that alligator, Elsie." And Mom, after a few days of thinking about it, said, "Okay, but we have to let Albert go back to Florida." And so they had this awe-inspiring, sometimes funny, sometimes sad journey from Colwood, West Virginia to Orlando, Florida.
Hickam says he first heard about his family's legend when he was a boy watching the television show Davy Crockett.
I was watching it back in the mid-1950s, and my mom walked in and looked and said, "I know him," and turned around and walked out. And it turned out that she was looking at Buddy Ebsen, who later played Uncle Jed in Beverly Hillbillies.
Hickam says Ebsen and his mom dated when she went to Florida after graduating high school, but they later became friends. When she married Hickam's dad, Ebsen sent her a very interesting gift.
Buddy's wedding gift to my mom was that alligator. And so I started over the years to try to find out more about Albert, and ultimately it became a family legend about their journey.
Hickam's newest novel, Carrying Albert Home, should be available around fall of next year. Hickam resides with his wife, Linda, at their home in Alabama throughout most of the year. But during his annual trip back to West Virginia, Hickam says he always makes a stop to visit his hometown of Colwood. While Hickam says he's always happy to visit home, he says Colwood has drastically changed from the time he was a boy, and sadly not for the better.
Now, unfortunately, with the coal industry the way it is, Colwood is just a shell of what it used to be, and it's kind of sad. When I go there, McDowell County, the population is about a quarter, I think, now what it was when I grew up there. So obviously there are a lot of empty houses with trees growing up through them. The infrastructure has collapsed.
Although Hickam is concerned for his hometown, he says the people haven't lost faith.
The people there are strong, they're intelligent, and they are working hard trying to bring the county back to some semblance of what it used to be.
Hickam continues to make a point to visit home annually, and he hopes that through the scholarships he has available at Marshall University and Virginia Tech, that more kids in the coal fields will go to college. Apart from being an author, Hickam worked for NASA as an aerospace engineer for 17 years. Now he continues to show his love of space and rockets, not only through his writing, but by working at Space Camp in Huntsville, Alabama. Hickam is on the board of this STEM-based camp. He says they don't get enough West Virginia kids, but he does see many West Virginia teachers that attend workshops hosted by the camp. Hickam thinks educators in West Virginia and Appalachia who are involved in STEM teachings are doing a good job. He says, however, that ultimately success comes down to the commitment of teachers and parents rather than just the technologies available today.
In my Colwood school, my class, over 90% of my class went to and graduated from college. We didn't have computers. The teachers had nothing but books and a blackboard and a piece of chalk. Yet, when I graduated from high school, I was well prepared to go off to Virginia Tech, to the engineering school, much better than a lot of the kids that were coming out of Richmond and Roanoke and Washington, D.C., and the big schools like that. Why? Because we had dedicated teachers, and we had parents who were fully engaged in the education process.
Hickam says after writing Rocket Boys, he never expected it to have the impact it's had on West Virginia and the Appalachians. And he's humbled so many people identify with his story.
When you write about West Virginia and the coal fields and so on, the easiest thing in the world is to write about the poverty and the hardship and the struggle and all that kind of thing. But what I write about is the optimism of the people and the good life that they have crafted in the coal fields of West Virginia and the pride that they have in the state.
Homer Hickam may no longer live in the state where he grew up, but he constantly recognizes and credits his West Virginia roots for making him who he is today. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
If someone calls you a butterbutt, that may sound like an insult, but it turns out that the butterbutt, the colloquial name for yellow-rumped warbler, is one smart cookie. In today's Bird Files segment, the Allegheny Front's Aiden Place, the show's resident teenage birder, lets us in on the strategic eating habits of this warbler.
This time of year, the yellow-rumped warbler is mostly brown and streaked with a touch of yellow on the sides. Not the most brightly colored bird, especially when compared with other warblers. However, there's more to the yellow-rumped warbler than meets the eye. During fall migration and winter, the yellow-rumped warbler's diet expands from insects, which is the typical warbler fare. The addition? Many servings of fruit, especially bayberries. Unlike any other warbler, yellow-rumps are able to digest the waxes and bayberries. This high-energy food allows them to overwinter much farther north than other warblers, wherever the bayberries grow. The birds have been found wintering as far north as Atlantic Canada. This is remarkable, as most warblers spend the chilly months in the tropics of the southern U.S. Yellow-rumped warblers use feeding strategies that are unlike other members of the warbler family. While they do search for insects along tree branches like most warblers, they've also been known to forage by flycatching and even feeding on the ground. From autumn to spring, yellow-rumped warblers form large flocks with other warblers. They fill the woods with flitting wings and a hard chip sound. So if you're out in the woods this fall and you hear a distinctive chipping, look closely. You might just see yellow-rumped warblers. For the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, I'm Aiden Place.
Aiden Place blogs at Pennsylvania Birding, and he's a sophomore at Winchester Thurston High School in Pittsburgh. Bird calls for this segment come courtesy of the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, recorded by Nicholas D. Sly and Michael J. Anderson. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Finally, we'll wrap up the show with a story about accepting a challenge and finding the inspiration to climb a mountain thanks to a 4-year-old girl. For years, Michael Barrick lived in a cabin near Blowing Rock, North Carolina, which is in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Before my wife and I moved back to my native state of West Virginia in the middle of 2013, we lived in another place that we consider almost heaven, a cabin deep in the Blue Ridge Mountains, just a few miles south of Blowing Rock, North Carolina. The cabin and the 57 acres it sits on offered the desperately needed sabbatical I required after retiring from a highly stressful job in a hospital about 40 miles away. It offered a time in a place that is the definition of peace. I helped my uncle build the cabin on the edge of Cold Creek at the end of a hollow. I spent many days hiking up to the high peaks in the neighboring Pisgah Forest. I valued the time alone, but also enjoyed visits by a friend of 40 years. We would sit outside enjoying the sunshine or moonshine, and sometimes both. We allowed the days to linger. We would take the occasional hike. but we never gathered up the gumption to tackle the ridge nearest to the cabin, as it is nearly straight up and full of rhododendron that are as formidable as they are beautiful. That all changed one day when I was watching our granddaughter, Atlee. She was a mere 4 years old at the time. The three of us were sitting along the side of the cabin, basking in the sun, listening to the creek. As we sat there, I did what friends often do. I offered a challenge. "Rick," I said, "you feel like climbing that mountain?" Before he could say no, or I could back out, Atlee jumped out of her chair, turned to us both, and declared, "I'm a climber. Are you?" Now that was the ultimate challenge. So without another moment of thought, we were climbing. I barely kept up with her, and Rick was falling behind. He hesitated. Atlee would have nothing of it. "Come on, Ricky," she exclaimed. "You can do it." Inspired, he persevered. In time, we reached the peak. What awaited us was a panoramic 360-degree view. To the north was Grandfather's Mountain. To the south, the steep slopes of the Blue Ridge Escarpment. To the east and west, Saddleback Ridges. Rick found an old path and disappeared into the woods. Atlee and I found a rock. She sat on my lap, her long legs hanging over mine, her head rested against my shoulder. The little fearless climber that I cradled with my arms had taught two old men a valuable lesson. Never, ever lose your sense of adventure. If you do, you will deprive yourself of unspeakable joy.
Barrick is the founder of the Appalachian Preservation Project, LLC. It exists to preserve the people, wildlife, land, history, and culture of Appalachia. He's a freelance writer living in Bridgeport, West Virginia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR and WBUR's Here and Now in Boston, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WUKY of Lexington, Kentucky, West Virginia Public Radio, and the Allegheny Front in Pennsylvania. Our theme music is by Andy Agnew. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.